Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me from the studios of CBS Interactive today, our guest James Heyer, MediaEdge CIA's brand new Chief Strategy Office. Hey, James.
Hello, how are you doing, Tim?
This week, James Packer buys into 10, Australia's greatest copycat ads, Google dominates site visits in Australia. Surprised? Another make an ad competition. Telstra goes back to the 70s. And 2.5 men, more popular than X Factor and Undercover Boss. But first we turn to James. Now, the first thing I must ask you is, I remember, you know, when I first started writing about media in the UK, I found the MediaEdge CIA such a baffling name. I noticed that you've almost started referring to yourselves as MEC recently. Is that the official moniker now?
Yeah, well spotted. It is the official one, because MEC... rolls off the tongue a whole lot better than MediaEdge CIA. So gone back to marketing 101 there, give something the clients can actually remember.
Well, do you know, funnily enough, I remember when I first came across it, I was thinking, is these people, you know, had delusions of being American spies or something, whereas I think back in the day it was Chris Ingram Associates or something.
That's right. Well, that's why I joined. I thought it was the CIA, and I've been rudely disappointed.
The mistake was finally picked up many years later. Now, you're relatively new in the role of Chief Strategy Officer. What are your first impressions of the market?
Nice thing about Australia is it's quite a hodgepodge of different cultures, especially actually in the media agency. It's a bit of a United Nations.
Well, mainly British and occasional Australians, but...
Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of the experience that people have, they tend to be cross-market experience. So the people coming in, yeah, they've worked in London, but they tend to have worked in a whole lot of other markets. So certainly in my office, there's guys that have worked everywhere from France through to Asia, through to the States. And, you know, just with myself, last 5 years, I've actually worked in 26 markets now. So, so whilst I have a bit of a UK accent, I think it's quite flat, mainly because I've lived the last 20 years in South Africa, but I've been based out of there the last 5, working for primarily Unilever, Heineken and SAB Miller, and wandering around to trouble spots in the world.
And the other thing, of course, is looking at your CV, which happily one of your colleagues sent on to me, so I have it here. You also worked on the within creative agencies in media roles, but back in the day, sort of with the likes of Leo Burnett, for instance, back in the days when media still lived in house. So I guess there's, you know, one of the biggest changes in, I guess, this generation of media is there's a whole bunch of people kind of coming into agencies now who work in media agencies who will never have been through the doors of a creative agency.
Yeah, and I actually think that that's a real shame, because I think both parties have actually lost out. If I'm dealing with creative guys right now, I work on a lot of pitches with creative agencies, and I did that in the last 5 years. And the fundamental lack of, in all honesty, media basics is really, really appalling. So, you know, that's their side. On our side, I think that, you know, the integrated team model, which I worked with at TBWA, is probably, you know, best in class as far as I'm concerned in my experience in the advertising industry. What we have now is not going to change. So, you know, we can cry over it and pretend it's going to go back, but it's not really going to happen. What we've got to do is get better at doing integration. And unfortunately, it's not going to be led by the agencies, because they're all fighting over their own bottom lines. It's got to be led by the client.
And what are your early impressions on the differences in doing business between South Africa and Australia?
Well, I mean, I'm not just going to look at South Africa. I'm going to look at a number of other markets in Australia. And the thing that, you know, is really great if you're in a media agency here is the actual profound strength, the sort of degree of interaction between both the media and the media agency in terms of the client, where in other markets, the creative agency, in all honesty, is probably quite far forward in terms of their client relationships and that sort of thing. In this market, the media agencies have definitely got a stronger foothold with both the clients and with the interaction with the media owners. Their ability to develop content and create campaigns without any help from the creative side is something that's not evident in a lot of markets.
And do you think that's because Australia is ahead of the process, behind the process, or has just gone a different route?
It's never one answer. So the one thing is Australia, I'm not saying, you know, is the biggest market I've ever come into, but it's certainly on the back end of a creative reel or roster, i.e. it'll work in Western Europe and North America, so we'll just send it down here and they can rerun it. So the creative agencies actually don't get the remit to create enough of their own work. So what happens is the media agency steps to the fore because they're the ones only doing the local work. So that's the one reason. The other thing is, I think it is, you know, a forecast of what's going to happen in the future is, you know, who's the best at developing content most adeptly in this interactive age. And the reality is, in terms of cost and speed to market and understanding of the changes in media, it's not the creative agencies right now.
And what's your remit going to be within the agency?
So my remit is, as they said, Chief Strategy Officer. What I'm trying to do is bring a more integrated piece to the agency. Even within agencies, there are silos. So whether it's digital or different account groups, or, you know, one side that we have is analytics and insight. So that's really sort of the background and the engine which gets the whole planning process going. These things need to be more integrated so that when we take briefs, it's that sort of many-headed hydra. So we don't know what the answer is yet, but we're going to have the right people in the room to be able to determine that. And I think one of the failings with our briefing systems, both in creative agencies and in media agencies, is that when we get the brief, sometimes it's not solved because of a lack of knowledge, lack of right people around the table to know which route to take. And what happens is we tend to go down a certain route because that's the people in the room.
And how is the agency itself going?
So the agency is a mid-sized agency that can be poised to go, you know, much, much further. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the network in both the States and the UK, it's actually incredibly successful. So it's a great franchise. And I think it's a dormant franchise sitting here in Australia in terms of its potential. So it's doing well, but it can do far better. And hopefully that's going to be my remit.
Funnily enough, literally just before I came in, I was leaked an email that went out from the agency last night to media owners telling them that they were so busy that they can't meet with them until the end of the year because of forward planning and everything else, which suggests to me that you guys must be busy indeed.
Yeah, we are busy on a number of projects, and that's what I'm willing to say right now.
So there's secret squirrel stuff going on that you can't quite yet talk about then. Now, going back to your previous experience, you were quite involved in the Unilever Marketing Academy. What was that, and what was your role in that?
So, I mean, it was three things, really. The first part was the really fun bit, which is writing content, which is going to be relayed and rolled out around the world. So I wrote a number of pieces, which are training programs, which is building ideas for growth, which is really, you know, how do you get the extended growth out of your product or whatever it is through ideas. Integrating channels, which is about how do you integrate channels into ideas. So it's great that you've got an idea and know you need more than a TV ad. So how do you build channels around that? I also wrote pieces for both sponsorship and PR, which I think is interesting because the remit of the comms planner now is outside of one discipline. And if you look at a laggard, which is something like the COI, which is the government communications piece in the UK, their criteria for a marketer now is to be adept in more than one discipline. And they're saying three and more, which means advertising probably, maybe PR, maybe sponsorship, maybe experiential response. Who knows what it is, but they're saying three or more, which means if the UK government has recognised we've changed, we've probably changed.
Absolutely. Well, next up, Packer is back. So Wednesday night saw James Packer explode back onto the media scene, picking up nearly 20% of 10. The Packer family, obviously much better known as the former owners of Nine. Now, James, to some extent, this feels like a slightly odd investment in that the market perception is always, well, free TV is kind of a dying medium. There's no value there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things really keeping it up right now in this market. And the one is the government anti-siphoning laws. And the second thing is the nature of the beast, which is how does pay TV grow and gobble up that share? And it's really about the culture of this place is there isn't one dominant sport, which Sky TV found out with football, South Africa found out with rugby. And what happens, that sort of ekes away at the potential of terrestrial TV. The other thing is it's a market where there is probably value in buying terrestrial TV now because of the downturn. So it's picked up a reasonably cheap asset compared to what others have been paying in the previous 2 or 3 years. And unfortunately, it's in his blood. He can't help himself.
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? That's the one thing with media moguls, whether it's Murdoch or anyone else, is it's the instinctive thing of for Murdoch must buy newspapers, for the Packers must have a TV network. Where do you see TV being in, say, 5 or 10 years' time? Will we still be making distinctions between free TV and pay TV, for instance?
I think the distinctions are going to be there just because of the nature of the audience. So if you're paying for television, you tend to be a more upmarket audience. Unfortunately as well, because of the plethora of choice that you have, you're going to have a different viewing experience, especially with whatever PVR 2.0 is going to be in 5 years, who knows. So there's a very, very different viewing experience, as well as right now viewer, that you're having to take into account. The other thing is the change is going to be in terrestrial TV, because they're going to be going digital. There's going to be a massive number of channels. So I think the distinction between the choice is what might actually drop away in 5 years.
Are you intrigued by IPTV, for instance? Will that be a big part of the mix, do you think?
I think it's something that's going to be, you know, evident in 5 years' time. We will know how it's going to roll out. I mean, there's been lots of potential with all sorts of different types of TV that we've been talking about, in all honesty, for about 10 to 15 years. So I think that'll play out over the next 5 years. What we have seen is, you know, the terms of the take-up and the technology changes, you know, becoming far more rapid. So I think in 5 years, I think that will be something that will play a really important role on the scene. And again, the only thing it's going to do is it's going to extend the choice, drop the potential for advertisers to reach people en masse, and make sure that we have to be much more targeted with our messages.
Well, next we talk copycat ads.
Did you hold a grudge against Montgomery Burns?
No. All right, maybe I did, but I didn't shoot him.
Checks out. Okay, sir, you're free to go.
Good, because I got a hot date tonight. A date. Dinner with Fred. Dinner alone. Watching TV alone. All right. I'm going to sit at home and ogle the ladies in the Victoria's Secret catalog. Sears catalog. Now, would you unhook this already, please? I don't deserve this kind of shabby treatment.
Okay, John, can you tell me your age?
36. 41.
Do you eat fiber?
Yes. Sometimes. No, I find it hard to eat.
This is new Kellogg's All Brand Wheat Flakes Honey Almond. Are you excited to try some?
Yes. No.
Are you surprised by how good it tastes?
Mmm.
Do you enjoy the nutty almond slices?
Yeah.
Can you taste the honey?
I can. I love honey.
All right. You can go now, John.
Good, because I didn't wax the ute. Wax my surfboard. Wax my chest.
So that was bartender Mo from The Simpsons failing a lie detector test. Then an ad for All Brand. So this week I put together a list of 20 copycat examples, which really got the Mumbrella comment stream flowing, I'm glad to say. And on a related but not directly related point, this week juice company Nudie jumped on the make an ad win a prize bandwagon with the challenge to people to make an ad about it's nothing but 21 oranges or nothing but 20 apples fruit drinks. The winner receiving the slightly random amount of $5,236 in cash and 21 bottles or 20 bottles of their chosen drink. So we've heard there a couple of examples of ads which, you know, have taken their inspiration from somewhere else. We've had the not entirely original idea of make an ad and win a prize. James, does it actually matter if a strategy isn't completely original?
The reality is I think we've got to look at the two actually quite distinctly. So I'm going to take your term copycat ads. I think it's quite a fat term. And being a strategery type person, you like to compartmentalise and segment everything.
Well, that's always the question, isn't it? You get your lumpers and you... strategic people, yes, they like to be able to get big groups and put them together, and others like to segment them. And I think as soon as you see somebody eating a meal, you can tell, depending how they eat it, which one of the two they are. But I digress.
Massively. Yeah, so, I mean, there's obviously the absolutely obvious paint and slap me in the face. That's the same commercial. And you had a number of media owners up there for that. And in all honesty, they don't care. In fact, that's where they go and find their commercials. So as much as you can, you know, denigrate their approach, that's the way they go to market. They're not going to change because it's the fastest route and it's the cheapest route. I think from an agency perspective, there's obviously a degree of pride involved. But again, there is the straight copycat, there's the inspiration, and then there's the whole genre thing. So, you know, is the Omo ad actually copying the Ariel ad because they're doing a whole lot of side-by-sides? Well, it's category Gen X. The SUV with the family packing it full of stuff and whizzing off into the distance, is that a category or is that a copy? There's also the lifestyle approach where you've got beer with three blokes in the pub, or you've got the chewing gum ads, which also all look the same. So the point here is it's not necessarily, it's a continuum, and you get the darn right copy to the inspire me a little bit, to the saw it on MTV, hope no one will notice, to the category generics, to the lifestyle generics. And I think that's why that the copycat is a very, very fat and loose term, and I think we need to be more specific as about what they're actually doing.
I mean, I just sometimes wonder, okay, you know, great, if you're trying to win an award or something, then of course it should be original. But to the client, does it matter if the same ad has run in another part of the world or a very, very similar ad if it sells units for them?
I think clients don't bother about this sort of thing. I think as long as the agency has been honest and the client doesn't find it later, it's a darn right copy, because then they can make a considered decision. And I think that's all the client wants to do is, you know, is it right for my business need? If it is, and thank you for telling me where you got it from, we can actually run it. It's finding out later that, you know, you pretended you slogged over it for, you know, 8 weeks, and actually you just drew it from an Argentinian reel.
And charged for it as well, of course. Next, we talk about the biggest online sites in Australia. So new Nielsen data, this is something that comes out about once a quarter or so, suggests that Google, Facebook and Microsoft own the most visited websites in Australia each month. So to run these by, this is for the Nielsen panel, so they kind of estimate the amount of audience. So this isn't just based on tracking actual site usage, it also is based on a panel as well. But anyway, the sort of numbers: Google 12.7 million online users per month, Microsoft 11.4 million. Now, that obviously includes things like 9MSN, Hotmail, those sort of things. Facebook next, so Facebook is third with just over 9 million. Then the Telstra sites, which obviously would include things like Census and Big Pond. Then Yahoo 7 here, as well as obviously those who use the email service. Then News Corp site, 6.9 million. So that would be things like The Australian or News.com or The Telegraph or the various news digital media sites, and so on down the list. James, it's probably not much of a surprise to see Google at number one.
No, you've got a bit of a man bites dog story here.
Yes.
The dog bites man is Google number five. So I'm not probably, you know, saying this is any sort of news. In fact, I'm surprised it took them so long to get there. And then, you know, in terms of the forecast, what's going to be really interesting is to see how the social media in the end starts gobbling up the time and, you know, the man hours that people start putting into media, and whether we start saying how long they're on Google is really important versus the time they spend on social media sites. So it's not just about the numbers.
Yes, I guess it becomes that, and to use your phrase, maybe it's a fat word, engagement, because there's more than one way of measuring engagement as well. But I know that's increasingly becoming part of the conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just about engagement. It's about engagement is, you know, did I get them to do something once? But then there's the relationship. How did I get them to do something afterwards? It's then the potential of that person that I got to do something, and I've got them to do something more. How influential are they? So there are a number of pieces as part of that engagement. And that's when I think we start double clicking on, you know, the whole area of interactive. And it's not as easy as how what your circulation is, which was in magazines. In magazines, we couldn't find out how many of their pages they flicked through, how many ads they actually saw, and what they did as a consequence of that. Whereas obviously with online, we can do a lot more of that. So I think we're going to get richer and richer and stop just looking at the billboard charts and wondering actually what they're doing on their time on these particular sites.
And I suppose that becomes one of it already is one of those key debates for online, isn't it? Just that question of, with so many measures available, how do you actually cut out the kind of the false signals and go for the information that you actually need to do your job as a marketer?
Yeah, and I think this is the problem. I mean, you've got to take the marketing objectives, and then you've got to say, well, okay, what behavior online will best reflect that? And then you say, well, how can I measure that behavior? Versus we start trying to go measures to measures, which doesn't really work. So, you know, it's all about attitudes that change behavior, and we've got to look for the behavior online that replicates those objectives best, just as you would do in any other channel. And the great thing is we can measure everything, but not everything's worth measuring.
And how big do you see the potential for behavioral targeting online?
So behavioural targeting is obviously something which is going to grow and grow. I think, in all honesty, it's going to be about what the payback is and how we can actually prove what's going on. So the fact that it's the most accountable medium on there makes clients, you know, want us to do more and more different types of measures and leaving all of the other channels behind, which I sort of find a little bit unfair. So in terms of measurement, I think, you know, they've almost dug their own hole, which they can't dig themselves out of, because they've got to keep proving more and more what the ROMI is of this particular campaign is going to be, whereas all the other channels, which have never really been able to prove anything, are left not having to do this.
And how far can you see it going? You know, for instance, can you see the time when every media agency is routinely bidding for the cookies of people who, you know, searched in the last 2 weeks for metal fridges so that they can serve up ads to them elsewhere? You know, will this generally become where the landscape goes, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there'll be lots of talk of cookie as a currency, but the reality is, I think what's going to happen is that there's a continual war between software that stops us being able to collect information and us being able to find ways to get around that. And I just see now that there's a whole lot of software out there that stops Facebook being able to know who on earth you are and what you're doing. So I think that that's the privacy issue that people are going to get more and more on top of and more precious about, the more intimate and the more stuff that they actually share with
us.
That's
the thing, because I guess logically, as a consumer, I would prefer to be served relevant ads, and I'd be willing for a certain amount of knowledge about my search patterns and surfing patterns to be available in order to be served the relevant ads. But I'm not sure that every punter feels that way.
Well, it also depends what you're searching. So, you know, relevance to a degree, relevance as long as no one else sees the ads that are being served up to me. So, there's degrees. If you look at a lot of sites where you can actually cut out the ads as long as you pay money, no one wants them. As much as, yes, if I have to have ads, I'd prefer them to be relevant. I'd prefer no ads. So it's all about that balance.
Mm. I suppose the other surprise for me in the data was that only about 3/4 of the Australian population appears to actually be online in any given month, which to me came as something of a surprise. And I wonder whether this kind of reflects that fact that, you know, sort of anyone working in the marketing industry, the trap they can fall into is they see the consumer in their own image if they're not careful.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the demographics of Australia. In all honesty, it's like Western Europe. It's an ageing population. And whilst they're younger, you know, the younger parties might be pushing their parents or wherever else it happens to be online, their use of online will also be limited. So it'll be limited to emails, to Skype, and to other ways to contact parties, you know, in a probably more efficient way. But use of online and the way that we see it as some sort of connection tool about my social life and how I manage my financial affairs is not going to happen, I think, in that older market to the degree that we see it now. And the problem is the demographics and the way that we're aging means that's not really going to change.
Well, next we go back to the 1970s with Telstra. Now for a bit of 70s nostalgia.
G-Force, five incredible young people with superpowers. And watching over them from Center Neptune, Seven Zark Seven. Watching, warning against surprise attack by alien galaxies from beyond space.
So Telstra appears to have drawn inspiration from the 1970s cartoon series to promote its new offering. The series Battle of the Planets, redubbed from Japanese, featured the adventures of G-Force. Next G, or Next to G-Force, as it's now been dubbed, is the new campaign from BWM for Telstra. So very similar territory.
Next G-Force, your laptop. Next G-Force, your YouTube. Next G-Force, your status update. Introducing the Big Pun Ultimate Device. There's nothing faster.
James, do you like the Telstra ad?
You know what? I think as a format it can break through. But in all honesty, I found the messaging really rational. It's really functional, rational, intrinsic. It's fast. So I think they lost the surprise of the format and then went straight down back to the brief. I'm probably more interested in part two and seeing where they take this. So I think they can build emotion to it. If you look at the campaign it replaced, it was obviously that soap opera type appeal. Which
Brad and Emma. Absolutely. I must admit, I hated Brad and Emma. I'm told, the first thing I did when the press release for this new ad dropped was I rang up the Telstra press office and said, are Brad and Emma dead? They're, no, we're resting them for this campaign, which was a disappointment, but... apparently, they did a poll of Telstra staff, this is what they were telling me, and Brad and Emma are their most popular characters amongst the staff.
Yeah, which I think is there's an element of confusion about that, because this is a fundamental departure, and I think, you know, like any other departure, it requires time to build and grow. And if this is where they end, I think that'll be a shame, because I don't know where it's going to go, but I think it definitely has legs. It certainly breaks through, and it's something they can own, because the minute I see any five-second tag of some sort of anime, I'm going to immediately think of Telstra, and hopefully it will be their ad. The thing I found really interesting, though, about this was the rest of the piece, where it's been accompanied by a series of initiatives negotiated by OMD, one of them being Telstra cost covering the cost of the city tunnel tolls. And I looked at the message again from the anime, which was about speed, and this was about free. And in fact, if you tell everyone it's going to be free, it's going to be congested, which means it's going to be slow and free, which is not the message of speed. So I find these initiatives where we find something that we think the client would like, and then we back-end it into a campaign, and it just confuses what the thing is.
So that was one of those bottom-drawer campaigns where we've got the idea of, hey, we'll pay for the toll, and then when the right client comes along or the closest you can, you pull it out of the drawer.
I mean, certainly that's what it feels like. They've got Telstra customers who use Jetstar will be given priority check-in. That's fast. That works for me. But when I see something like free toll, I'm wondering, what on earth are you thinking? And in the end, the client is the executive credit director. They signed it off. It's their fault.
I wonder as well, with something like Telstra, and this some of your Unilever experience might sort of inform this, where you've got a company as big as Telstra, so it's got its sort of sub-brands, whether it's NextG for the phone network or whether it's Census for the kind of the search services or 1234 or whatever the phone number is, you know, and then the landlines, and you know, then the mobile service, and then you know, come and buy the iPad in the Telstra shop, and so on. It must get pretty difficult when you've got the big parent brand and then the sub brands to come up with something consistent across everything. Or actually, does it not matter so long as each of the sub brands are consistent?
No, I mean, it really depends whether you're going for a branded house or house of brands. They've gone for a house of brands, whether that was the right strategy given they're a corporate brand, I think is, you know, up for grabs. The problem is, in all honesty, Telstra in this market is not the most well-regarded brand. So what happens is they can build up their parent brand through these sub-brands. And I think Sony is in something similar like that, where they have a whole lot of different brands who are at different parts in their life cycle, and some doing well, some not. I think in the end, you need that overall understanding of what this whole piece is about. So the whole thing, anime, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's an interesting departure. But, you know, given that they haven't sorted out the big brand itself, I think it makes it all feel quite strange. So they do need to do the bigger piece. I think they need to understand where the parts fill in. And some of them need to be corporate brands. So they need to be branded house type pieces. And where there are things that are successful, something like Big Pond, I think they can keep that going quite happily.
Well, finally, we talk about Two and a Half Men, Uber Alice. So it seems that if you want to win the ratings, then sadly, I guess, US sitcoms beat local productions. Monday saw Two and a Half Men outrate Seven's X Factor elimination show. And also, not a local production, but I was rather fond of Sherlock on Nine as well, which was the BBC production. Meanwhile, local versions of Iron Chef and Top Gear didn't actually do that much better on Tuesday. James, the value of local programming versus big US or wherever sitcom franchises, does that sort of environment matter to advertisers, or is it just about what they write?
I mean, environment always matters, but in the end, they've got to deliver the numbers. And if I look at something like Two and a Half Men, it's not just about the fact that it's sort of not homegrown. It's about the fact that I understand the show and it's been running for a number of time and I've grown fond of it and I'm familiar and I'm comfortable. And it's also got that broader audience, which means a family can sit down in front of it and all enjoy it. And that's one of the problems with, you know, especially on terrestrial television, you've got a mass appeal. It's not the niche audiences where I can throw out and distribute amongst different channels. I have to have the one size fits all. Two and a Half Men does that extremely well. And the great thing is it's embedded itself in the culture of you know, this country. It's embedded itself well in this country, one, through just longevity, and secondly, it's a very easy formula to understand.
Now, what are your early impressions of the TV networks? You know, you're obviously relatively new to the market, but clearly you're the sort of person they're going to need to influence, because you advise your clients on, in the end, where to go. Who's impressed you as operators so far?
I'm not going to pick any favourites, because I think that would be a little bit unfair, especially as I'll need favours in the end sometime. What I think is interesting, and it comes back to my first point about the cooperation between the media owners generally and media agencies, and having met with a number of the television partners, the content they're able to bring to help, you know, your clients and your campaigns is quite phenomenal. Also, their turnaround time and their costs are something which are really conducive to making sure that clients, you know, can have something delivered which they're happy with. And again, allows the media agency to be on the front foot. So I think there's a really symbiotic relationship that's been developed over time in this market, which is quite different to a lot of markets. In the States, there is a lot of this multi-channel partnership with media agencies and media owners, but it's not that common in other markets.
One of the things that strikes me is one of those kind of common things I've heard said more than once is you'll get someone moving over from the UK market in some sort of trading role, and they're kind of used to quite a robust negotiation where effectively the media agency has the upper hand. And you'll kind of hear almost with amusement one of the sort of sales guys from the TV network will say after all, yeah, they've calmed down now. And there's this it appears to be the most common kind of trap is for people to come in and think they understand the market when they don't, particularly when it comes to the comes to who's actually got the upper hand in the negotiation in this market.
Yeah, I mean, there's not that much choice that allows the media industry to be absolutely in the driving seat. And I mean, as much as both parties would, you know, downplay their role, I think they both have their strengths. But certainly the media owners in almost any market, because there is quite a lot of either duopoly or, you know, large holdings by smaller parties of the media landscape almost anywhere. So apart from really, really big markets, I think that's something you have to take into account. The media owner does have the upper hand in terms of has the content, has the inventory that you're looking for. And, you know, three terrestrial networks doesn't give you a lot of room to play in.
Well, that is us done for today. Just a reminder that there is no Mumbrella cast next week. That's because we'll be in Melbourne for Mumbrella Question Time. That's next Thursday morning, October the 28th. There are still tickets, so go to mumbrella.com.au to register. Thank you very much to our guest, James Heyer.
No problem. Thanks a lot, Tim.
And also thank you to CBS Interactive for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle pip.